Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Regrets? Biden has a few, or at least one, plus TikTok on the chopping block. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined, as always, by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Noah Rothman, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a Nash View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are the How the World Works podcast from CEI, the University of Austin, and David Bonson's new book, Full Time. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, MBD, Joe Biden has been taking this triumphant post-State of the Union tour, except he has been getting hit from the left on his use of the word illegal to refer to the murderer of Laken Riley. And Biden initially said, well, you know, I don't know whether I regret it, but, you know, we're talking about someone technically who shouldn't have been here, technically, you know, like this guy parked in the a loading zone for 10 minutes when he shouldn't have, rather than, you know, coming here deliberately to violate our laws and cross the border and stay illegally and then committing this heinous act. And then in an interview with Jonathan Capehart, he said, he was asked directly, do you regret this? And he's, no, it's undocumented person. And then went on to talk at some length or further explain that illegal immigrants have built this country and are the reason that the economy is growing. What do you make of it?
So this was a disappointing thing for Biden to say. I mean, he put himself in the position of apologizing to, I don't know what, the community of depraved murderers for offending them. This is, you know, a sickening gesture on his part. But in some ways, it's not surprising. In some ways, it doesn't surprise me. Because for many progressives, they suffer from a kind of moral delusion that real acts of violence are sui generis. But any instance of prejudice contains within it all the evils of the world that flow through it. That by using the word illegal, we are on the verge of starting a pogrom that will inevitably result in the Holocaust. Because we've dehumanized someone through language. And so you see people genuinely react with more anger towards these verbal miscues than they do toward actual crimes. It is a crazy thing for Biden to have said, because it was an opportunity for him to ventilate real anger and in a way to relate to the American people about the chaos at the border. And instead he's retreated into the worst, you know, bubble-like cliches of the far progressive left. He's totally out of step with his party, or totally out of step with the nation.
So Noah, you pointed out that Biden briefly was, but the White House was briefly flirting with the idea of some executive actions at the border to try to tighten up the place. They had two opportunities, natural opportunities, to announce such an action or actions. One, when he visited the border a week or so ago. Two, the State of the Union last week. Nothing at either event. And now it seems as though nothing is coming. And if you take what Biden said to Capehart seriously and follow the logic of it, why would you want to enforce the border more if these illegal immigrants are coming in and building our country? Our country needs to be built, and native workers apparently aren't up to it. So we need more illegal labor.
Yeah, the trajectory of the evolution of Joe Biden flirting with the prospect of doing his job only to be convinced or convince himself not to is actually kind of humorous when you divorce yourself from the horror of it all. Early January, Joe Biden was out of options, according to NBC News. No more options until Congress does something to fix the statutory language, make something more permanent. And then as hopes for the bill faded in early February, mid-February, well, he found out he actually kind of had a few options, but they were the, quote, plan B. Nobody was happy about it. But listen, the border crisis had become so acute and it was finally registering in the polls that something had to be done. And in late February, he was considering doing things that are actually in the language of the Senate supplemental, up to and including changing the credible fear standard by which asylum seekers get residency status, thereby entirely undermining the notion that Joe Biden couldn't do anything that was in the Senate supplemental bill without congressional authorization. It seemed like that was the way things were going until yesterday on a tarmac in New Hampshire, where he told reporters that he's back to waiting on Congress to do something and his hands are tied in the absence of it. So the stage is set now for this theater, and American voters are reduced to theater critics. We have to determine who is putting on the better performance. It is to Michael's point, and I wrote about this after the State of the Union address, that ad lib was his best moment. It was the first time the president has even approximated something resembling the passion that most voters bring to this subject. They're angry over the situation at the border. Joe Biden presided over it. He can't get away from his culpability here. But in a, you know, mirroring at least some of the affect that most voters have, probably would have done him a world of good, at least insofar as it creates some distance from the progressive activists who have led him so far astray. But this White House cannot handle it when progressives are even a little bit frustrated with him, and they evince the exact same prejudice that they accuse the right of when they insist and convince themselves that there is no assimilationist tendency among American Latinos. There's no poll that justifies this. If you look at the data, supermajorities of Latino Americans, Hispanic Americans, support border security, support increased control of illegal immigration on the southern border. It was 10 years ago now that Nate Cohen at the New York Times was looking over census data and found out that a lot of American Hispanics now identify as white, not because they perceive themselves to be Caucasian, but because they perceive themselves to be fully integrated Americans. That's just a universal sentiment now that we need actual border control, and it doesn't offend Hispanic Americans when you use derogatory language to describe somebody who kills their fellow citizens. They're not offended by it. The only people who are offended by it are progressives who have insulated themselves so much from actual, American public opinion on this issue that they convince themselves of these weird fictions. And Joe Biden is absolutely hostage to it.
Yeah, so it wouldn't have been transformative, but there was, you're absolutely right, an opportunity for something of a sister soldier moment here, right? The left says, how can you use that word? And Biden just could have said, blown up, you know, get over it. Get over it. But of course, he didn't do that and can't do that or doesn't believe he can. So, Charlie, what do you think of just the general Democratic euphoria? Biden is back. You know, Biden's out there more, you know, riding the wave from his successful State of the Union, et cetera.
I think it's silly. Can I answer a different question? just to go back to the illegal immigration thing, because I think this is really important for a number of reasons. And tells us not just about Biden and the Democrats, but about the progressives who are behind him. This use of the word illegal came in an unscripted exchange. And that in and of itself is telling. Because when people, especially older people who have grown accustomed to talking in a particular way, are unscripted, they often say what they think.
Yeah. They she shouted out Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, say her name, and he said her name, and then he said, she said, you know, he's killed by an illegal, and he was like, yeah, an illegal. So it was a little bit under her prompting, but also
it was
reverting to common usage the last 30 years. Yeah,
yeah, he doesn't think that it's offensive because it's not; it's descriptive. I think that it's so silly to suggest that anyone should have a problem with the use of the word illegal when illegal is what those people are. They are illegal immigrants, as distinct from immigrants who are here legally.
Right. And it's not as though, like, it's not as though immigrants, sorry to interrupt again, but it's not as though immigrants encompasses everything they are. You know, if they're a mother, you'd also call them a mother. Or if they, you know, they're a busboy, you'd say they're a busboy.
But when it comes to immigration, they are illegal.
Right.
And before I was a permanent resident, I was a visa holder. And until I was a citizen, I was an alien. I was. It's not offensive to note that. It's true. I was an alien. That's the word that we have used for a long time. It comes from the Latin alienus.
Mm-hmm.
Illegal is a good word.
It's written into law over and over again.
Everywhere. And Biden knows this and probably thinks that too, as most people do, and most Democrats did until about 10 years ago. So that's the first thing that's interesting. The second thing that's interesting is what Noah said, which is that he just can't do it. This was a gift. Now, I don't know how this is going to play out, and I don't want our politics to proceed under these terms, but the parents of the young lady who was killed, Laken Riley, have been vocal about Biden and the border and his fluffing her name, and I believe they had a phone call with Donald Trump.
I think they met. They actually met with him.
Met with Donald Trump. Most people in the United States think that what happened in Athens, Georgia, is more important than what we call it. And I think Biden was given a real opportunity here to stand on the side of common sense. It's overplayed as a category, but to exhibit a sister soldier moment and say, no, I want to fix this. Now, that he doesn't is a problem, but at least say it. At least say, I'm not getting involved in this. But he didn't. He repudiated the use of the word, and then he said illegal immigrants built this country. He went one further. It wasn't just that we shouldn't use this, or let's be nice, let's be prissy about language. He said, these are the best people. These are the people who built the United States. This is our backbone. No, no. So that's very, very bad. Why is this happening? I think it is because the progressive movement believes that if it can stop people using these terms, then it can effectively muddy the debate and end the ability of those who dissent from the status quo to complain about it.
Mm-hmm.
As I said at the beginning, illegal is a necessary descriptor if you are to distinguish between people who came in with permission and people who came in without. It is akin to criminal or tax evader. If we're going to have taxes, we're going to have people who are compliant and people who are not. If we're going to have laws, we're going to have people who follow them and people who do not. And we're going to have words to describe that.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that every single tax law is good. Of course it's not. It doesn't mean that every enforcement mechanism or funding mechanism for the IRS is good. It doesn't mean that every law we have is good. There are lots of laws that I would like to see repealed. But if you're going to talk about that, which one should we have, which should be repealed, which should stay, and so forth, then you're going to have to be able to distinguish between the people who are on the right side of them and the people who are on the wrong side of them, even if you think the people on the wrong side of them are sympathetic or shouldn't be there. But if you take away the ability to determine who is one and who is the other, if you succeed in doing what the left has done here quite well, such that the average article you read in the Associated Press is incomprehensible because it says migrant for everyone. It describes migrants being arrested or deported. Why? Doesn't say illegal before it. If you do that, you've actually destroyed the ability of people to discuss politics around immigration and thereby to attack what it is that Joe Biden is doing. That's why they do it. It's partly identity politics, but the main reason is linguistic control. Mm-hmm. And Biden has bought into this, or at least he feels the need to display some fealty to it. And once again, it is going to hurt him so badly because Donald Trump doesn't care about any of that. There is no one in America who cares less about any of that than Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump is going to be his opponent. You would have thought this was a gift from the heavens to Joe Biden, where he could have said this guy wasn't illegal and what he did was terrible. And my administration, he could even lie. He could even say it's because the Republicans didn't pass the bill. Whatever you want to say, politics ain't beanbag, but he didn't. And I think this is yet again an inexplicable instinct on his behalf.
Yeah. So I was looking back at the debate over the terminology, and it's amazing. In 2012, people are hammering the New York Times for still using illegal immigrant, and their immigration reporter is like, no, this is a neutral descriptive term. The editor is like, no, it's not our job to adopt, you know, the fashionable phraseology from one side of a political debate. And of course they buckled long ago. And if you're going to play this word game where they say, well, you can't use the phrase illegal immigrant because no one's illegal. Well, is anyone really undocumented? I mean, all these people have documents. They have bogus documents, maybe, that they're using in this country. But they certainly had documents, you know, when they were back in their home country. So why are we calling them
undocumented? I mean, it doesn't apply to asylum seekers either. Asylum seekers are not illegal. They're mm-hmm. in the system. They have residency as a function of their seeking asylum. So it's not even an effective descriptor there.
I mean, I've been in this position. I had a visa. It had an expiry date. And I had two choices. I could either renew it or I could... Well, three, I suppose. Renew it, go home, or stay in the country illegally. How else could you discuss that scenario? This is just so silly.
So, MBD, I ask a question to you. The apparent decision by the White House just to write out basically the situation at the border and point a finger at Republicans for not going along with this bipartisan deal is, in political terms, complete madness, bad tactics, good tactics, or brilliant?
It is complete madness, and I think they know it, and I think the only thing they're trying to do to alleviate it is jaw with Mexico to try to stop the flow there without really doing anything about it themselves.
Noah?
I'm going to say it's bad, just because I can see a rational person rationalizing themselves into the notion that they can make hay out of and offset some of the blame that the White House deserves for overseeing this migrant crisis, and say, you know, it's Republicans own some of this too, just because they haven't done anything. And the Senate supplemental is in the abstract popular. So I can see how they would convince themselves of it, but I don't see how it bears much fruit.
Troy?
I think it's madness. And I think that if Donald Trump wins this election, this is going to be one of the main parts of any autopsy that is done.
Yeah.
I think they're going to say, how could it possibly be the case that Joe Biden, knowing who he was running against and what that guy's number one issue was, allowed himself over and over again to be painted into the exact corner that Donald Trump wanted him to be in?
Yeah, it is complete madness. So I do think, as we've discussed before, they get some mileage out of saying Republicans haven't passed this bipartisan border deal because Trump told them not to, but that's not nearly enough given their direct responsibility for what's happened at the border. So they need to be doing that. And at least theatrical things, you know, ideally things that actually make a difference at the border. And, you know, if Biden were Bill Clinton, he'd say, I'm going to have a summit with Greg Abbott. You know, maybe that's not possible because Abbott wouldn't want to do it. Or I welcome what Texas is doing at the border. You know, maybe they shouldn't do it right in this spot, but I'm going to, you know, order Border Patrol to help them string up barbed wire in various places. You know, something like that just shows a major sea change. But they're just going to this election with a massive vulnerability, which, as Charlie points out, suits ideally the political strengths of their opponent. With that, let's pause and hear from our friends at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, who are back with new episodes of their breakout How the World Works podcast, hosted by author and political commentator Kevin Williamson. If you're not already listening to the show, each episode, Kevin sits down with notable guests for candid conversations about the jobs they've had and the role of work in the economy and our social lives, from flipping burgers and tending pigs on a farm to leading special ops missions in far corners of the globe. Some of America's best thinkers discuss the jobs they've had that informed their outlook on life and future careers. In a recent episode, Kevin sat down with Jonah Goldberg, both of whom are old friends and colleagues of National Review, of course, for a fascinating conversation about the ins and outs of Jonah's decades-long career in the media. So be sure to listen to How the World Works wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit cei.org/howtheworldworks. That's cei.org/howtheworldworks. So, Charlie, we have a congressional committee in the House that has passed a TikTok bill unanimously, 50-0, that would force the Chinese parent company ByteDance to sell this very popular app that all the kids use, unfortunately. Is this an appropriate way to address this issue?
I think it is, unless the bill at any stage roves into the question of content. The United States is not supposed to superintend debate. I find TikTok appalling, but that is irrelevant. What the United States is permitted to do is determine whether or not a given company can be owned by a foreign adversary. In my view, it can legislate pretty broadly on that question, but especially when it comes to matters of national security. The federal government exists primarily to keep an eye on national security. And TikTok is owned by a company, ByteDance, that is enmeshed with the Chinese Communist Party. This is not a scenario that we should accept. It is reasonable for Congress, therefore, to say, okay, you can keep operating. We will not oversee or edit or censor what your app hosts or promotes, but that app will henceforth be owned by an American company or a company owned by one of our allies, and not by the Chinese Communist Party. And if it's not, it will be banned. And the law, despite what Thomas Massie keeps saying, and as our listeners will know, I am generally extremely hostile to the idea of any government intervention in tech. But Thomas Massie is wrong when he says that this is a slippery slope and that this bill could be applied to any other tech company. The term in the law is owned by a foreign adversary. That is simply not applicable to Facebook or Twitter. It's not applicable to a social media site owned by, say, the British or the French. They aren't foreign adversaries. The Chinese Communist Party is, by definition, and ought to be, a foreign adversary. So I think this is a good move. I think it's a necessary move. I would finish by saying that people underestimate the extent to which TikTok is spyware. A lot of social media apps are spyware in some sense. They collect huge amounts of data on us. It's true. Most of the criticisms that are made of Google, big tech, they're true. They do collect as much data as they can and then sell it. But we do have laws about this, and perhaps we should have more. But we cannot impose the same laws on the Chinese Communist Party. They don't care about those laws. They're not going to follow them. This app is extremely intrusive, and its data is sent back to a company that is the tool of a foreign adversary. And I don't think that's an acceptable situation. I don't think it undermines the First Amendment or any principles of free enterprise to suggest otherwise. The Chinese Communist Party is not a free enterprise player, and I hope this passes.
So, Noah, the interesting progressive Substacker Matthew Yuglatius wrote about TikTok today, and the comparison he made was, what if during the height of the Cold War, a Soviet company came in and said, we're going to buy CBS, or maybe not even CBS, which at that time was just one of three broadcast networks, but we're going to buy a whole bunch of local TV stations. There's no way that possibly would have been approved and would have happened. And he says that the same thing should apply here.
Of course not. I mean, it's a little different. And I'm sure TikTok's defenders would raise the minutia distinctions between mass media companies and social media user-generated content. But the analogy pertains. We don't even have to go that deep into history to see something of a precedent for this sort of thing. The gay dating app Grindr was in a very similar situation when the United States Committee on Foreign Investment repeatedly warned the Beijing-based engineers who had access to its users' private messages, HIV status, etc. that this was a national security threat. It could be used to blackmail people. It compelled the firm to divest, which is what this bill would do. And it did so. And that was the end of that. It's telling that the subsidiary that owns this, that TikTok in China, would apparently rather scuttle the whole platform than divest its holdings for many, many millions of dollars.
Exactly.
Because it is what it is. We all know what it is. It's a tool for spying and, to a lesser extent, a tool for psychological manipulation. And we saw that in the reaction that TikTok promoted from its user base when it tried to lobby members of Congress against supporting this bill. Lobbying is a constitutionally protected activity for very good reason, but it's not without consequences if it's done in a manner that reflects poorly on the individual or institution doing the lobbying. And that's exactly what happened. Members of Congress were inundated with threats, some of them violent threats to members themselves or their families, emotional blackmail as users, many of whom were audibly young, threatened to kill themselves if TikTok were taken away from them. Some of them were apparently in school. You could hear the sound of school bells in the background.
That's healthy.
It's hideous. It's also a reason why we should be engaged in a very serious conversation about getting smartphones out of school during school hours. But that's
beside absolutely. Yeah, we had a debate about social media and age restrictions. No, in an episode you weren't on a couple weeks ago, but that's something everyone agrees on.
It's such a digression, I could go into it, but all I hear is phone addiction whenever anybody talks about this, because I'm of the generation that grew up with things like payphones and offices, and somehow we all survived to adulthood. But nevertheless, that's a digression. Still, so we have this very well-funded effort on the part of both Republicans, Club for Growth types, lobbying in favor, and even up to and including Donald Trump, lobbying against going after TikTok, because the real threat to American security are American billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg and Democrats.
So MBD, that's what I wanted to get you on. So Trump has reversed on this. There are some people, you know, it's not totally unreasonable to say, look, this is a very popular thing, so you're going to hurt your image among young people if you ban or force a sale or it goes away because China destroys it because of something you've tried to do. I mean, I think young people will adapt. There'll be the other short video apps and options for them. But also Trump has had this meeting with this donor who is a big shareholder of TikTok and very forcefully arguing against any congressional action. And Trump totally changed his tune in fairly short order on this and says the problem with moving against TikTok is you're going to make Facebook even more powerful, and Facebook is an enemy of the people.
Where to begin? I'm not worried about what this will have to do with Facebook. I think Facebook's been very slow to adapt to a changing social media square, and I think that the entrepreneurs that would get in after TikTok is cleared out of the way would probably eat his lunch and Meta's lunch anyway. So it's ridiculous.
All right. Next question to you first, Charles C.W. Cook. TikTok will be forced to, ByteDance will be forced to sell TikTok, or TikTok's somehow going to go away because legislation in its current form. Legislation will pass Congress and be signed by President Biden. Yes or no?
Yes. Although I think the outcome will be that the Chinese Communist Party's indirect ownership is transferred rather than that TikTok is banned. And I think the reason this is going to happen is that those legislators have seen the details. I have spoken to people who have, to some extent, reverse engineered this app. And what they have shown me is horrifying. I'm sure the legislators of both parties have seen this. The other reason it's going to pass is that it's really difficult to defend. And in fact, the people who are defending it sound ridiculous. Many of them are the same people who said that a few ads on Facebook led to the 2016 election being stolen. Some of them talk all the time about the importance of buying American and bringing jobs home. And they're what? Going to go to bat for the Chinese ownership of a social media app? This is going to pass. It's going to pass, if not unanimously, close to it, and it should.
Noah?
Yeah, I think it passes, and that it is signed into law by the president, and most likely China divests its holdings, and it's not, the app isn't banned from the App Store, which is the consequence of this. If it doesn't, if it fails, it will do so as a result of a very well-funded campaign, as Charlie said, by people who are adopting populist language in order to promote something that is of interest only to people who are very well invested in this product to the tune of billions of dollars. And I think that's probably less likely to happen than not. So I think it does pass, though with some consternation from the quote-unquote populists.
MBD.
Can I just ask Charlie a factual question before I answer the exit question?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Charlie, does the divest law, is it firm that China would have to sell it to a third party that is not subject to China's national intelligence law? Or is it just it has to be a non-state company?
I don't actually know. That's a good question.
It's US-based.
I think it has to sell it to an American company, though.
An American company. Okay, so. Then by definition wouldn't be subject to national intelligence law in China. That's the only thing is, there are no private parties in China, so it would have to be outside. I think it'll pass because I think legislators have figured out that they can minimize the electoral downside of this with young voters by just being as bipartisan as possible. If in a way, it's like if everyone jumps at once, no one can be held especially responsible, and they can get this done.
Yeah, I think it'll pass just because there's just such bipartisan sentiment for this. The only question is the Senate. I mean, there's not a question in the House. So TikTok is actually focusing on the Senate, and maybe if it doesn't pass, that'll be the reason. But I think it will. And with that, let's hear from our second sponsor this episode. The University of Austin, or UATX, the newest university in America, is accepting applications now for fall 2024. UATX's founding 100 students will each receive a full tuition scholarship to attend class at the university's downtown campus in the heart of Austin, Texas. UATX is building a new institution grounded in the wisdom of the past and launched towards the knowledge and insight of the future. Students will study the liberal arts and sciences with distinguished faculty and work with Austin mentors who've started companies, pioneered discoveries, and built from the ground up. Visit uaustin.org. That's uaustin.org to learn more and apply to join the University of Austin's founding freshman class. This is a thrilling opportunity. There are very talented and wise people who've been working on this project very hard for a while now. And the fact that it is approaching fruition here and they can get on the ground floor is really exciting. With that, Noah, we've talked about this a little bit, but it continues to heighten the clash between the White House and the Israeli government over the war in Gaza. Going back to the State of the Union, it wasn't just what Biden said from the podium that was alarming. There was this hot mic moment where, you know, classic Biden style, he's telling this congressman, don't tell anyone, you know, as he's on a hot mic. I'm going to have this come to Jesus moment meeting soon with Bibi Netanyahu. The White House is saying it's a red line that the Israeli government cannot go into Rafah, which is the last major stronghold that they need to hit to rout Hamas. And the Israeli government is saying, no one's going to tell us not to go into Rafah. And you even have leaks, people saying the administration would consider limiting weapons or what the Israeli government can do with U.S. provided weapons. What do you make of it?
Yeah, conditioning foreign aid, so military aid to Israel, offensive aid, not defensive aid necessarily. The Iron Dome ordinance that intercepts missiles, for example, but the offensive stuff. The White House is incredibly schizophrenic on this issue. Often in the same breath, they and its members, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, and its functionaries, will say, you know, Israel needs to win this war. Hamas cannot persist as the governing entity in Gaza. But at the same time, we strongly object to them invading the last stronghold of Hamas, neutralizing this entity, and winning the war. And this makes sense, I suppose, to the progressive activists who have some sort of a bizarre mesmeric hold over this administration. But it doesn't make sense to anybody else. It's entirely contradictory. Some people perceive there to be a little bit of kabuki theater here, just designed to mollify a very unsympathetic and small in number cast of progressive activists to whom the administration is exquisitely sensitive whenever they experience any discomfort. But it seems more likely to me that they actually do mean to frustrate what Israel is trying to achieve here. And they are sort of, to an extent, Israel's actually navigating this pretty adroitly when the president says something, for example, that would frustrate their objectives. The Israeli government does try to make the most of it and demonstrate that we're all on the same page here. Most recently, this pier, the supposed aid pier, which will take 2 months to build and require 1,100 American servicemen to construct. Nobody knows how this aid will be administered, but it will be coming out of the Cypriot port, inspected by Israeli officials, and then distributed somehow, in some way, by incontested territory, if it is still contested, in 2 months' time. And Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, who's one of the members of this tripartite, cross-partisan government that has been governing Gaza or Israel since the war started, that he's welcoming it. He's saying, you know, this is great. It'll contribute to the end of Hamas's rule. We'll bring aid in, and it'll be inspected, and the goods will be imported, and it's all good. And it makes sense that they would say that, because the Israeli government has been administering an aid regime, the distribution of aid, to the tune of 304,000 tons of aid so far since the war began. And it's been a very costly enterprise. It puts IDF soldiers at risk. It gives them no favors. It buys them no goodwill on the international scene, especially when things go wrong, and sometimes it does. The Israeli government admitted that at one point IDF soldiers were mobbed recently, I think of 2 weeks ago or something like that, and they fired warning shots over their heads. And when that didn't work, they fired at their extremities, and civilians were injured in that. Some civilians have been trampled, run over by aid trucks when they, you know, attack them, because this is a terrible situation. Gaza's a nightmare hellhole right now, and it is a humanitarian catastrophe. And even though you can say that Hamas and its misrule are responsible for all of it, the headlines are not good for Israel. So why wouldn't it want to offload some of that responsibility onto the United States? America's offering. They're saying, we're going to take off some of the burden here on you. Why wouldn't they welcome it? You can say that this is designed to frustrate Israel's objectives, and certainly it's designed to create the impression in American minds and in international minds that Israel is not administering this aid regime to the satisfaction of the civilized world. But the outcome of this will only be to let Israel, you know, to some extent off the hook, give it some ability to say, well, this is now America's problem, not ours. The administration doesn't really seem to have a strategy here. It is just flitting from one PR crisis to the next without very much of a desire to see through the objective that it needs, which is for Israel to win with all due alacrity. Only then will the Biden administration recoup some of the political capital it's invested in Israel's war.
Yeah, so MBD, this has gotten worse than I expected. We were all kind of had realistic expectations for how long the administration would be stalwart on Israel's side. You know, I think we're on average, we're saying, you know, they have a month window. But I never thought we'd get to this point. We'd have these sort of threats, whether they're followed through by the administration or not. They're extraordinary in their own right. And how much of this do you think is just flat out outrage over the shock and outrage over the humanitarian situation in Gaza, which, as Noah points out, is dire, and how much of it is just looking at uncommitted votes in various primaries, or just the energy on the left over this issue, where this is, you know, the State of the Union was disrupted, the Oscars were disrupted, various Biden events, you have protesters and hecklers. How much of it is just sheer political judgment, looking at how upset people are on the left and hoping to placate them?
I think it's mostly looking at how upset people are on the left and looking to placate them. I think the portion of the left that has had their opinions on Israel sort of transformed in this cascade over this last year is has outsized influence in the party and in the media. You know, and I think it's become uncomfortable for the Democratic Party to be a stalwart advocate for Israel, right? I mean, it is. I mean, look to like the European Union. Every single country except one has demanded a ceasefire, and every single country except one voted for the EU to have a resolution demanding a ceasefire. Who's that one country? Hungary. It's not exactly the club that Joe Biden wants to be in. And yeah, this is becoming more and more difficult for them. And I think it's hugely consequential for the Democrats long term, because I think they are pushing themselves into the wrong position here. I mean, I think, again, I just think there's so much evidence, and I've pointed it out before, that John Fetterman in a swing state in Pennsylvania is doing everything he can to embrace Israel, to talk about the hostages, and to basically laugh off people who throw the word genocide around or mm-hmm. wave Palestinian flags in his face. And he's doing 20 points better than Biden in that state. Maybe he's onto something.
Charlie.
I've come to the view that a lot of the criticisms of Israel that we're seeing that are not motivated by either intersectional politics or good old-fashioned anti-Semitism are the result of a actually admirable in a vacuum opposition to the very existence of war. That is to say that most people, especially in the United States, don't know what war looks like. And they're rightly horrified by it. Unfortunately, not every war is the product of shadowy forces or overly bellicose leaders. Sometimes there really are bad guys who will do bad things until you stop them. And merely reciting the horrors of war, which are real, isn't enough. And so while I have a great deal of sympathy for the way that some Americans have approached this, in that I think it's admirable to recoil from the casualty numbers we've seen, the photos we've seen, I ultimately think they're naive. And I think that naivety is being supercharged by a hangover of opposition to the Iraq war and other wars that seem to be chosen, or at least have come to be regarded by history as having been chosen. And I think that's a problem for Israel, because Israel's task here, and a task that it is going to fulfill really irrespective of what anyone else thinks, is to wipe out Hamas. And wiping out Hamas is not nice. It's ugly. People who lived in different eras would perhaps instinctively understand that. If you'd lived through the World Wars or Korea or Vietnam, perhaps you would understand that. But most of us didn't. And I have slowly realized that there is a real shock, an understandable shock, at what responding to this sort of evil incursion requires. And not everyone has set it in its proper context.
So Noah, next question to you. This situation is going to lead to a fundamental breach or fundamental change in the nature of the relationship between the United States and Israel, yes or no?
Well, it has already, and it may continue to accelerate insofar as the Israeli government has committed itself to a crash course industrial program of developing its own domestic ordnance development capabilities in the event that the United States becomes an unreliable ally. And that's part of statecraft. Every government on earth needs to have a contingency plan in the event that a profound change in the character of a government or regime with which it is allied changes the calculation to the point that it has to think about its own defense vis-a-vis its allies. That is a healthy prospect for Israel to undergo, even though it is discomforting to those of us who look on the Israeli-American alliance and are thankful for it. But in the short term, no, I don't suspect that this will have a profound effect on American-Israeli relations, just by virtue of the fact that they are a very critical partner in a very unstable part of the world, and they will continue to be a source of American security, and vice versa. Israel needs us as well to provide not only defensive ordnance, but diplomatic cover in international institutions. So our symbiotic relationship will continue for the foreseeable future, but it is on a rocky course, and Israel has acknowledged that.
Amity?
I think in the short term, there won't be fundamental change, but I think we're seeing Israel perhaps sliding to where other nations are, where they turn to us when we've got one administration in and not when we have another. You know, like similarly, like, you know, Hungary now openly sides with the Republican Party and basically consigns itself to be ignored or denigrated when the other party comes to power in the United States. I think you could see more of that coming across in international politics. I mean, we're seeing it as a trend in the EU, where the Brussels openly favors the governments of some states over others based on who won. So I'm worried about this fracturing where we put an ideological screen on our relationships rather than being based on history and shared interests.
Charlie?
I'm less convinced because I'm just not sure that it's real. I think it's perhaps real in the sense that Joe Biden is unusually supine in the face of progressive criticism. But if you look at the fundamental dynamics of American politics, they are supportive of Israel and of the American alliance. The Republican Party is solidly pro-Israel. Even the people within it who don't want us to help Ukraine don't extend that to Israel. And the Democratic Party, unless something radically changes in the demographic makeup of our coalitions, still has most of the voting Jewish American population. And I don't think every Republican and Democratic president of the future is going to make the same calculation Joe Biden has. I think they're going to see where the sentiment is and where the votes are. I expect it to maintain pretty well. And even if there is a short period in which it seems rocky, alliances that are built on something, and this one is, do tend to survive. The British, for example, did not help the United States in Vietnam, but by the 1980s, that alliance was the strongest it had ever been. So I'm just not convinced that this is real.
I think the answer is no, there will not be a fundamental change. With that, let's hear from our third sponsor this episode, David Bonson's new book, Full Time. It is deep in the ethos of National Review that work is a bedrock in a flourishing society, and that work is a pivotal component in the God-given dignity of every person. Economist and financial manager David Bonson, our friend and colleague, has taken this message to its full potential with his brand new book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life. Whether it be in public policy, in the culture, or even in the church, too often work is seen as a necessary evil and not the universal blessing that it is, David argues in this brand new book, for the economic, theological, and ontological significance of work, suggesting that it's core to our identity and that the fastest way to a failed state will be to continue in this low regard for work that ignores our God-given capacity for productivity. David does not shy away from defending work as a therapeutic, cathartic vehicle for dealing with challenging circumstances in life, and ultimately argues that the other things we value in a well-ordered life, marriage, children, community, worship, are all enhanced when we properly prioritize and centralize work. It is not a book on work that you've ever read before. Get David Bonson's Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever fine books are sold. That's Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. And check out more at fulltimebook.com. com. So let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, speaking of books, you've been reading the novel Help Wanted.
Yeah, Help Wanted is the second novel by Adele Waldman, who I used to know about 20 years ago in New York City. And it's about a teen movement that is the 8 employees of a big box store who arrive 4 a.m. every morning to unload the truck and unpack it into the store. And it is a funny comic and surprisingly touching read. All these characters carry themselves with real dignity, and they are not just props or tools in the author's argument. They really have a story of their own. I'm enjoying it a lot.
Noah, continuing to talk about books, you've been reading Bill Sapphire.
That's right. I had my dad handed me a copy of Bill Sapphire's On Language, which is a compendium of his Times columns on language. And it is just absolutely delightful. I don't have a lot of time to read for fun, but I had some when I was on a plane this weekend for work, traveling a little bit. And it's just such a fun read because they're very quick pieces, quick columns. And they're accompanied by 2 or 3 bits of reader mail where he's either corrected or criticized or agreed with. And it's kind of jaunty and light. And he has all these fun little phrases. And it plays with language in ways that I find incredibly gratifying, like among them. He was talking about the crisis of atomization that has afflicted the intellectual class of his era, and he called it, deemed it anomie-tooism, which is sort of a portmanteau that incorporates like Republicans who were Me Too Republicans who had come to terms with the New Deal. Has this little vignette on how everything calls itself a center now, a vision center, this center, that mm-hmm. center, and how morticians will soon be calling themselves dead center. Mm-hmm. It's just truly enjoyable. Prose, and I just was not familiar with, I was a little before my time, not familiar with Bill Sapphire's On Language columns, and this is an edifying and enjoyable read.
So Charlie, while everyone else has been reading books, you've been building fires on the beach.
I have. I don't need everyone's sympathy, but I must relate that it was unfortunately 50 degrees yesterday, and in Florida, this is enough to trigger a mass panic. And that mass panic took us to the beach where it was perhaps even colder, maybe something like 49 or 48, if you can imagine such a thing. And so we built a fire. We dug a hole in the sand and built a fire, and it was absolutely so terrific.
Just grab scrap wood on the beach?
Drift actually, wood, yeah. Wood. Well, we did bring a little bit of wood, but there is enough scrap wood on the beach. And we lit the fire with the edge of a pizza box, drank some
wow.
wine,
watched what's, the kids what's play. Skills?
Oh, it's astonishing. Awesome. It's astonishing. They may make documentaries about us in the future. Yeah.
How to survive 49-degree weather. Charlie Cook. So I'm also going to mention a book. I think the kind of the last place where you can just have really random experiences finding books you're not aware of is book sales, informal book sales. So there's one at a library not too far away. Once a month, they do a little book sale, and we went there. And you know, if you go in Barnes & Noble, I don't go very much anymore. But you will find books that oh wow, I wasn't aware this author had written that, or that there's this book on that topic. But it's all kind of new editions. And I found this edition of Victorian Minds by Gertrude Himmelfarb. That's the first edition from 1968. It has a very kind of classical, classic dust jacket with an endorsement from the great Lionel Trilling. And this was obviously part of someone's library for a very long time, because you can tell because the spine is faded where it was exposed to the sun, whereas the rest of the dust jacket was not. So I'm not going to immediately read this one, but it's nice to have and probably cost me about $2. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
For me, it's 2 pieces this week by Jack Butler. One is France's Abortion Vote is Another Revolution. And then he has a follow-up, France's New Revolution Continues. And I just think Jack gets at the most essential Burkean theme of conservative political thought and applies it where it first belonged, which is to the machinations of the French.
No, what's your pick?
It's going to be Phil Klein's. Jonathan Glazer is only comfortable with a Jewishness of victimhood. He apparently watched the Oscars, so we didn't have to. God bless him. And took John Glazer, who accepted a Academy Award for a movie about the Holocaust, and used the opportunity to refute his Jewishness, his phrasing, not mine. And Phil dissects this outlook that is prevalent among progressive liberals who are discomfited by a robust and active jury that is willing to defend itself in lethal terms, which discomfits progressives who are far more apt to view Jews as defensible and noble when they accept their fates like placid Hindu cows. It's a good piece. Go read it.
Try.
There is a piece in the magazine by Jeremy L. Shane called Why Medicare Should Pay for Weight Loss Drugs. Now, this, when I first read the headline, elicited a knee-jerk reaction in me, in that I don't want Medicare to pay for more stuff because we are running out of money. And it seems to me like an indulgence when I see people say, well, they're taking weight loss drugs. I always think, isn't that cheating? But I have to say, it's quite persuasive. The bill that seems to have inspired this piece, or perhaps was inspired by this piece, was introduced by Bill Cassidy, who is a Republican senator from Louisiana and also a doctor, a liver specialist, in fact, who knows quite a lot about obesity and the way it interplays with the liver. And I don't know. I think there is a case here that if Medicare did pay for weight loss drugs, then there would be less obesity and there would be less disease associated with obesity. And perhaps that's one way to help our entitlements crisis. So it's certainly worth reading. And I would very much like to read somebody who disagrees profoundly write a counterpoint.
So my pick is also a magazine piece by Mark Krikorian, the president of the Center for Immigration Studies, How to Fix the Border. And Mark and his colleagues are just so sound and so reliable on this issue, and you know you're getting the best thinking on the border and immigration policy when you're reading Marx. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or countless game without the express written permission of National U magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, MBD. Thanks to How the World Works, the University of Austin, and Full Time, David Bonson's new book. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.